Thank you, everyone. Good morning. My name is Professor Lettner Simbai. I am the Acting Chief Executive Officer at the Human Sciences Research Council. Dear esteemed panelists, ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to host you as our guests at this dialogue. I would like to thank the Department of Science and Innovation for funding this dialogue and the Strategic Partnerships Directorate in the Impact Center at the Human Sciences Research Council in partnership with Women in Science for making it possible to hold a strategic dialogue, given that it is the Youth Month and the country is faced with many challenges that affect our youth. The month of June commemorates the Soweto youth uprisings of June 16, 1976 in South Africa. As we reflect on the contributions of the youth of 1976, we are reminded of the significant role the youth continues to play in our country and the challenges they still face. Every nation that cares for its development invests in its youth for the sake of a better future and world. On the first of this month, 1st June 2021, Statistics South Africa released the quarterly labor force survey report. This report showed that the official unemployment rate in South Africa increased by 32.6% in the first quarter of 2021 compared to the last quarter of 2020. Sadly enough, the unemployment rate is the highest among people aged 15 to 34 years. As the country continues to grapple with the effects of COVID-19, millions of South Africans are at risk of losing their jobs. This is a gloomy picture that will require innovative research approaches to confront these challenges and harness the fourth industrial revolution. The strategic plan of the Human Sciences Research Council includes utilizing the national, regional, and global leadership in the production and use of targeted knowledge to support the eradication of poverty, the reduction of inequalities, and the promotion of employment. The Human Sciences Research Council is the largest research institute in Africa that focuses on the social sciences and humanities. It produces and disseminates knowledge that contributes to policy options and programs on poverty alleviation, solutions to reduce inequality, and innovations for employment creation. It is in this spirit that the Impact Center at the Human Sciences Research Council has convened this meeting in order to help us understand the underlying challenges facing the youth in the current economic climate. We will interrogate the much commended potential that the fourth industrial revolution holds, and also to ensure that youth is prepared for a technology-driven economy that requires young people to be proficient in science, technology, and digital literacy. As knowledge producers and policy actors, it is critical to ensure that we understand the potential that the science advancement brings with intact thoughtfulness of our socioeconomic conditions and opportunities. With these few words, I extend my warm welcome to all of you, and I do trust you will enjoy the deliberations and contribute to the debate this morning. Thank you very much.
Prof, you are muted.
Yes, I said thank you very much. Who is the master of ceremonies? Michael.
Hi, Lagnes. Palesa, shall we proceed?
Please go ahead, thanks.
Okay, thank you very much, Lagnes, for putting our dialogue in context, both within the Youth Month and the work of the HSRC. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for this interesting and important dialogue as we reflect on the youth in the past and the youth in the future. My name is Michael Gastra. I'm the Acting Director of the Science and Society Unit of the HSRC. I'll be chairing our panel today. And I'd like to welcome our panelists. We have a really interesting set of panelists today, some of which are colleagues. I'd like to introduce Chris Chetty. He's a chief researcher at the Inclusive Economic Development Division of the HSRC. He's worked a lot in the digital space. We're looking forward to his insights. Then we have Wandile Ngxaweni. She's a researcher at the Makungubwe Institute for Strategic Reflection and also part of the Fees Must Fall protests at the University of Johannesburg. Then we have Lihle Nkomo, who's a digital transformation specialist at the CSIR and a management consultant. He's worked a lot in the tech and digital spaces too. Then we have- Series coming up. Then we have Nomso Kana, who's a nuclear scientist and also a digital entrepreneur. He has some very interesting perspectives on youth and tech in this country. She's a former colleague of mine on the Presidential Commission on the Fourth Industrial Revolution. Then Matete Bale Kleani, who serves in the Agape Youth Movement, which is a nonprofit company. And she'll be addressing this question from the civil society perspective, I would imagine. And then Sipelo Nkwangu, a lecturer in the Department of Sociology at the University of Johannesburg, specializing in the role of labor, business, and the state in the making of South Africa's skills development regime. So panelists, I welcome you all. We look forward to your reflections on this topic. We'll each have a few minutes to speak. And then once the panelists have completed their talks, we'll open up to the floor for some questions and answers. So without further commentary from me, I think we can go directly to Krish.
Thank you, Michael. Good morning, everybody. I have a few slides that I'd like to share with you. So I'm just gonna put that up and then speak to this. I shouldn't take too long. So I'd like to share a few practical ideas about how technology can offer us a few new opportunities for work and perhaps solve some of these deep youth unemployment challenges that we're facing in the country. So the story begins with what we know about youth unemployment. It's substantially higher than the adult unemployment levels that you see by this red line in the graph. And comparatively, it appears that youth unemployment remains almost twice as high as adult unemployment in 2020, which you can see with these yellow highlighted squares. And this has been a consistent problem perhaps for more than two decades. And any gains that we were making in the lead up to 2020 has been reversed after COVID, as Prof. Simbaya has mentioned. So it also tells us that our youth employment programs perhaps are not working as well as we'd like. And so we need some new innovative ideas that will help us reverse that cycle of poverty and find some new opportunities for work for young people. One intervention we could promote is integrating digital literacy in all aspects of the school experience. In the developed world, this is a norm. Digital technologies are embedded almost in everything you do in school, and usage is natural, and learners become more comfortable using tech as a daily part of their work. We need to reach this level of comfort because we're finding that digital literacy can help you access those entry-level jobs that you require. Often where you need just some generic skills to perform routine or manual tasks. So your digital skills are very valuable, and it may help you transition across sectors and into different jobs. So then you'd be able to apply your skills in different contexts. But the main goal is for you to be able to add value for an employer. In one of our studies that we did, we looked at the different jobs that were posted on Career Junction, and we mapped this against five different digital literacies. In these word clouds that I'm showing, the bigger the word, the more frequently it was requested. And we found some interesting skills were valued. For example, in the computer literacy space, operating Sage was a key skill. This is a ERP system where you basically capture basic details about the day-to-day operations of the business. In the information literacy space, being able to work with data is key, but also being able to find information online through web searching was quite common. In the media space, graphic design, using Photoshop. Communication, you need the ability to write reports, that's essential, and also understanding how email works and so on. So these are basic ideas, but essential for your first job. And in the technology space, you see various types of coding gets referenced. But a key message I'd like to share here is that not every job will need coding skills in the technology space. I'd now like to just go over a few examples of technology advancements that are impacting a few sectors. For example, in the creative sector, we're finding some new opportunities for creative workers in the gig economy. Our musicians have easier access to the market now using platforms like iTunes and others. In Cape Town, the creatives have an opportunity to engage with the Cape Town Film Studio through crewpencil.com. And here your extras can find work and full companies can go about sourcing supplies online. In the blue economy, we're finding some interesting apps which have been set up to support the fishing community. Here it follows a cooperative supply chain model, needing the fishermen to log data about their catch and their experience. And then this app connects them to a distribution network to reach restaurants and families interested in getting fresh fish. They are in operation at the moment, and they were one of our essential services under our lockdown. It also shows that our fishermen need to be familiar with digital skills and being able to work with the phone, have a bank account, and then be able to communicate with their customers online. In the education sector, it's important to recognize online tutoring, particularly in this COVID period. We've seen the burden that teachers and parents have faced trying to help their learners stay on track. But mass tutoring perhaps provides a solution to balance the load and improve the quality of learning and create new jobs. There's a few apps in South Africa offering these services, but for it to be effective, we really need some more massive investments in digital infrastructure and digital skills for both learners and tutors. In the construction sector, there's many new jobs which need to be filled right now. New technologies are entering the household, which need us to have some digital skills. In Cape Town, due to the drought that we had, we needed a large number of digital water meters that were installed. So we need people that can maintain these sorts of systems. The same with gate motors, the same with solar water heaters. We'll need maintenance workers to ensure that this sort of infrastructure can continue to be used. And so basically, to conclude, we know there's many challenges that young people have faced in the country, finding work. We hardly seem to have made a dent, perhaps, in this unemployment challenge, but we need perhaps to look to technology for what opportunities that may offer us and help us reimagine the world. There's also a need for us to empower ourselves with digital skills. Basic level skills can help you find work, but one must then continue to develop your skills and work out how you can apply these skills in different environments. And as I've shown in the last few slides, there's a variety of new jobs which are emerging, which may offer you those new opportunities. But the key message is that we need ingenuitive problem solvers who will be able to either create jobs or be able to find those jobs that are emerging. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you very much, Krish, for those thoughts and for the example of the blue economy. Our questions and answers come at the end. I'm sure we have some discussion points for Krish, but we'll save them until the other presentations are complete. So I'll just ask Wandile to proceed, please.
Morning, colleagues. Morning. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear and see you loud and clear.
Thanks, colleagues. So I wanted to perhaps begin at the beginning of my presentation, because it's going to be 5 minutes. I guess at the middle of it. So I want to argue about the issue of the skills mismatch. And of course, this has been a long-standing problem for South Africa. And we must ask how to utilize 4IR and other interventions of innovations to address this problem. Youth and 4IR interventions need to solve the coordination issue of government and policy support interventions. Currently, everyone is doing things in their own corners. Some programs are repetitive and expensive and produce very little results. And how we need to find how to use technology to know who is doing what, where, and the impact of such. The private sector should be able to utilize technology to close the gap between the skills they want, training skills and skilling institutions, and young people who need employment. And of course, Mistra has a chapter in a book titled Leap 4.0 on two types of employable people that the previous speaker has also touched on. This is particularly important because they can absorb both. These are high-skilled employees, which are the creators, users of complicated technology, and the low-skilled, which are the monitors of technology and such. And of course, these need some level of education, including the low-skilled ones need some form of literacy. To go on a more deeper one, I want to argue, and of course also this argument is made in the book by the Mapungubwe Institute titled Leap 4.0, is that we need to contend with the fact that 4IR has brought with it new platforms that impact on long-standing economic models. As we know, its technology is redefining the landscape of commerce, we need to consider the impacts of new technologies on labor relations and market structures in the economy. 4IR has come to place greater emphasis on comprehensive substitutions of technology for human labor with higher returns on capital. It was not conceivable before in the old era to experience economic growth without increased employment. Yet 4IR, we see today is decoupling the growth from employment. In SA, we are moving at a quick pace to integrate the real economy as we know it with dynamic digital technology. The platform I'm talking about here, of course, is, as you might have guessed, is Uber, Netflix. Just the other day, I heard that the Musica store in Samsung closed. And of course, this is then supplemented by Apple Music and other digital streaming platforms. And of course, this impacts on tax collection legislation, employment laws, competition, and other local domestic laws which govern labor, the economy, and employment. We must not say we have no idea of what 4IR is going to bring, because policy and government, we must not say we have no idea of what 4IR is going to bring. Policy and government response to 4IR needs to take cognizance of the idea that they have realized the trends in which 4IR is taking us. And of course, the problem is that these platforms operate within a global economic model, and government needs to contend with law and needs to contend with how they affect developmental goals. There needs to be a coordinated effort to draw policy that enables young people to capitalize on these trends. So 4IR for entrepreneurship, I want to argue also that we must seriously consider how we only think of 4IR in relation to employment in the traditional sense, being that the employer-employee relations, and instead think of 4IR in the sense of innovation and business and creating entrepreneurship. Now, I want to spend some time on this because in a book from Misra again, there's a chapter there that I wrote in the book titled Beyond Entrepreneurship, Rethinking Black Business and Economic Empowerment. This chapter focuses on young Black entrepreneurs, and they speak on a number of barriers that they face. And these barriers, I want to argue, have an impact on how South Africa views 4IR policy. And so there's a barrier in the economy that the people that I interviewed for the chapter, they say they experience a barrier into the economy because the sector in which their businesses operate, which are ICT related, their online retail, online automotive businesses, and online catering services, which of course operate on a number of platforms, including Facebook and Instagram, and all these young entrepreneurs are arguing that of course there's a racially monolithic economy. And AI then proves, and these new economies then are proving to be, again, exclusionary of Black entrepreneurs, specifically the young ones, which is the race barrier. Young people interviewed also enjoyed relative success and higher education background, had a higher education background, but then, which then means that education is still a barrier again. The less successful entrepreneurs in the space argued that their main problem is funding. And of course, funding, as we know, in South Africa is very difficult to to get. Some of them also speak about how there is the monopolized business sectors when it comes to ICT-driven businesses. Of course, some of the one of the businesses was competing in a space with Bidvest Security, which really was a big task. So again, the argument here is that ICT innovation driven businesses are being started by young people, need to be considered by youth development policymakers, and technological change is underpinned by innovations. But young people need to be seriously considered for these places. Now, again, there's another unpublished chapter that I am writing currently with Dr. TK Poe, which interviews Brown Sense. As you know, you might know, it's a market platform. It promotes and assists Black businesses. It's deliberate about giving Black-owned businesses access to markets. They have about 200,000 members and 200,000 customers. So it's a whole ecosystem of people that benefit from each other. And the market is an example of how through online applications, doors open for new markets, doors specifically open for the informal and SMME sector. And technology is the one that drives these innovations and drives business growth within sectors which otherwise do not have market access currently because of the markets in South Africa and racial bias which exists. And again, what comes out is that the ability of informal businesses to adapt to online and technology is very possible and highly accepted and welcome by small business players. And so youth have a big opportunity to enter through SMMEs and through informal businesses, even during a time as difficult as COVID, to kind of reap the rewards of technology in terms of how it can scale. Yes, in terms of how it can scale and open new markets and give opportunities to young people. Sure, thanks.
Thank you. Thanks, Wandile. Apologies for truncating your presentation. I'm sure we can elaborate more on all those ideas in the question and answer session. It is always interesting to hear the thinking coming out of MISTRA with its interdisciplinary focus, looking at ideology and politics and economics. So we look forward to your participation in the debate. meanwhile, we will move on. Lihle, would you like to present?
Yes, thank you so much. Good morning, everyone. My name is Lihle and I'm from the CSIR. So basically the way that I see it is really the job market has been highly impacted by the emerging technologies. And we see that a lot of jobs that were previously having a routine nature can now be automated. So to be able to address this shift in skills and knowledge that is required, I think we have to look at it in three levels. So the first level being the youth themselves, it is to say, how can we create an awareness? How can we be more intentional about the skills and the knowledge that we go out there to obtain? And we've seen in industries that there's the demand is shifting towards two main areas. So obviously the first one being that there is a need for technical skills. And we see jobs with titles such as data scientist, we see social media marketers, and those type of roles gaining a lot of traction. So, and then in the second space, we're looking at more social skills. So we need to be able to be in a position where we can solve more on the creative side, we can cultivate critical thinking as well. And then we see on problem solving, we require more people with complex problem solving capabilities. And this becomes very important because these are some of the things that no matter how advanced digital becomes, we will still need that human element to come through. And as the youth, we should just be in a position to continuously cultivate the culture of learning, because we see that the pace at which you know, these technologies are coming through is very quick. So we need to be able to be in a position where we are also willing to learn at that pace and quickly adapt to that technology. And then the second stage, we're now looking at what can organizations, both in the public or in the private sector, do to empower or give opportunities to the youth. And the big thing really would be for organizations to map out a skills gap analysis, so that we're able to see that in the next 2 to 3 years, what are the jobs that are going to be highly demanded in the market. And this could then enable the youth to be able to position themselves or to skill themselves, targeting those skills gaps that were already identified in industry. And this also speaks to the upcoming youth and also speaks to reskilling the people who are within the jobs already, so that they can be able to do a job-to-job transition as we go forward. And what is really important here is to realize that when there's a job-to-job transition, it doesn't mean that one job will directly replace the other. That's why we see that some industries might completely be removed, while we see other industries growing and demanding more in terms of like the workforce and the capabilities within that space. And then we also see opportunities where organizations could start partnering with individuals to provide training, so on the job training, but to give them skills that they could use beyond that job space. So to give the youth skills that they can use to go and open their own either businesses or be able to empower more people within our communities. And then on the third stage, we're looking at what could government do then to empower or to help the youth to be more for IR ready. In this space, we're looking at things from you know, policy development, we're looking at things from creating incentives for either organizations to want to partner with the youth, creating incentives for specific skill sets that will definitely ensure that the youth is more prepared for the digital era. And then we see also in terms of a need for having training centers that promote practical application of these technologies, because we hear a lot of buzzwords in industries from artificial intelligence, blockchain technologies. And I think the curiosity is really to say, how do those technologies practically apply in the mining sector? How do they apply in the financial services sector? And once we start getting that appreciation as the youth, then we can start seeing how we can use those technologies to improve the environments that we're in. And we see that like in the locations and where we come from, there's a lot of room to either impact spaces such as informal markets to see how can we better digitize these industries and help our communities. But if there is a gap between knowing what technologies are out there and how they can be practically implemented, then we'll run into that challenge of having not knowing exactly how to practically implement. So I think between the organizations and government and us as the youth, we need to really start working towards being intentional about the skills that we are getting and being intentional about wanting to utilize those skills to improve the communities that we're in. So yeah, all in all is to say we should not only focus on having one skill set, but we should also have a mixture, because in the digital economy, really, it's about having a bit of your technical skills and your social skills so that we become dynamic individuals in the job market. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Lihle. I hope we get some debate over the role of skills in all this. It's also interesting to hear from our sister organization, the CSIR, on digital skills. I guess our work overlaps in that area. And next up is Nomso. Good to see you again, Nomso. The floor is yours.
Thank you so much, Dr. Kastrov, and good morning, colleagues and patriotic South Africans. I hope everyone is well, healthy, and taking all their immune boosting medicines and all of that, so we can just curb the rise of COVID in this time. Thank you once again for the invite, HSRC. And my submission for today is really looking into how do we ensure that the economy grows, and also the main participants is the youth. In the year of 2018, the African Union came up with a theme called demographic dividend, which is now to invest in your youthful population so as to grow economies. I think serving in the 4IR Commission has really given me an eye-opener on how we can really utilize this era, the 4IR, to ensure that South Africa is competitive economically, and also we use 4IR to solve our socio-economic impediments and all the issues that we see every day. We know the dominant ones, it's inequality, poverty, and unemployment. And unemployment, unfortunately for us, hits us in the working group. The CEO has said it very well, and Stats SA has given us the numbers. And we have, as the country, we all know that we've been in a technical recession for some time. But, you know, we do have sectors that really perform. And I think those sectors must take lead in ensuring that the demographic dividend is looked after. Colleagues, as I was reflecting on this topic, and we know it's the Youth Month, and we're closing it very well with these meaningful conversations, and the discussants have already put forward some of the great ideas, like what Ms. Gomo have mentioned, and also our colleague, Mr. Ngaweni from Mistra, and as well, Mr. Petty. But I just want to make a submission and an argument. Number one is that, you know, unemployment in a capitalist system is not a crisis, because capitalism loves cheap labor. So if we have been crippled with 70, over 60% of unemployment in the working group, it means we are really heading for danger. And we really have to have our solutions in unemployment, and we have to look into the digital economy in really tapping into solving this huge issue that South Africa is facing. The chronic unemployment issue is that we have to strictly look into our economy, which sectors are performing. We know that every year the GDP is well-rounded, and the major sectors that contributes to our GDP, it's finance, and it's real estate, it's business services, as well as government services. And we can look at sectors like wholesale, retail, motor trade, agriculture. But I want to focus into the financial sector. You know, last year, our major banks, they made a whopping 50 billion in profits. And most times they're not involved in the discussion of youth unemployment. And perhaps maybe it's the skilling part where, you know, South Africa, you know, we have a youth that has been labeled that it is unskilled or does not have the right skill for this time, this era that we are in. But, you know, that being said, I really feel, you know, as an entrepreneur, as also an advisor in government, that the private sector needs to play a role in solving this issue. And playing a role, it needs to ensure that it ensures that South African youth participate in the digital economy. So the digital economy has these big bets that I want to just quickly go through. Number one is the physical technology production, digital traded services, transformative tech applications, and digital platforms. This is where we can ensure we have employment for the youth. They are skilled for these big bets in the digital economy. And also just lastly, we should have critical enablers such as digital inclusion, skills for work, responsive government, innovation and competitiveness, and government digitization. If we have these enablers, they will ensure that we play a role in the digital economy by working in these digital bets that I've mentioned, and also ensure that our economy is growing, there's job creation, and also it's transforming every day. And the youth plays a role in this. As I've mentioned, we have to invest in the youth because they are the ones who will take the future forward. Thank you so much.
All our speakers have so much to say in so little time, but we'll circle back to those issues. next, I'd like to invite Matsetse Bale to speak.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I'm not sure if I'm visible and I'm audible. Can you see and hear me?
You're up. We can see you.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Colleagues, I struggled a little bit as I was preparing for this conversation. I was wondering, how can I approach this? We know that youth unemployment or unemployment in general is systemic. It has been growing over time and is multifaceted. So there's so many things that we could say about its causes, solutions. We can spend the whole day here. We can converse about all the currently implemented interventions to curb youth unemployment. And the reality of South Africa is that young people need jobs, and they need jobs as in yesterday. So I always ask myself, what are some of the low-hanging fruits that could be there that we could start to explore to give young people jobs now? And I'm just going to go through this conversation to tell two stories, very much personal and close to home, that would express how I think maybe we could make use of some of this low-hanging fruit. You go to communities, you find economic activity, but the question is, are young people participating in this economic activity, and how do we absorb young people? There's where I come from in Lebowakgomo, there is a family that has a small business. They are in the pest control business, and they also do farming, and they've got a son, a young person whom I can express that they struggle with matric, and they, I think, might have been one of those people that fell through the crack. But what I've seen, and I think there's no better time than this month to express and celebrate Youth Month, because we know what this month means. It's a celebration of youth agency, young people taking leadership. And with this story, there's this young man who then takes the reins and starts helping in the family business. And then where it really connects with the fourth industrial revolution is he then starts to, you know, bring in innovative ways for marketing, for business processes and all of those things. And the business then grows. The dad is always shocked at how do we just get all these clients. The only thing that he did was just to take the business and put it on Instagram. And when his friends need the service, they contact him, and then there's business. So you see an Afrocentric kinship model where young people could look into their communities and families for job opportunities at the moment, where there could be a skill transfer from their uncles, from their fathers, from their aunts, to do something that they could do now and learn firsthand in their homes. This young person's dad also has a small farm. And I mean, the dad took very long to understand some of the dynamics in farming. But because he has a phone, he's able to check which breeds are the best, what can we do, where can I get training, and all of those things. And quickly, I'm just going to try and share just a picture. It's not a presentation. It's just a picture so that we can see what I'm talking about. So I'm not sure if you can see the screen. This is a young man, 22 years of age, transformed his family business, learned a great deal from the dad, did not finish school. And there you see him still wearing the business uniform at his father's farm. And if you look very closely in the crowd, you'll see that there's a Bonsmara breed, which is one of the best beef breeds. His dad was just doing Nguni, and he was not commercially viable in his farming. So just expressing this is just saying they are some of the low-hanging things that in our communities, I believe young people can make use of and learn and get jobs. Here he is with his parents to show how families can play a role in making solutions towards this youth unemployment issue. The organization that I work for, Agape Youth Movement, a few years ago, it was not an organization that was employing young people. It was just a project-based organization. And over time, based on a group of young people's leadership agency, they came up with ways through which they can structure this organization so that they can find employment in something that they're passionate about. And today, Agape Youth Movement stands as one of the organizations that supports National Department of Basic Education to implement national virtual youth leadership programs. Because when COVID hit last year, DBE did not know how we're going to further implement some of the school-based programs. And Agape Youth Movement was given a chair on the table to lead a process through which young people are able to go through youth development facilitated by virtual platforms. A curriculum that also focuses on digital literacy that gives young people the competitive edge to interact on online spaces in a safe manner and use online spaces to reach their full potential. So in essence, this is just me saying, before we go national and try to come up with very complicated and innovative and very valid solutions, what are some of the low-hanging fruits that young people in the country could grab and start creating jobs in the spaces that they are in? Thank you very much, Michael. I'm very much aware that my 5 minutes is finished.
Thank you so much for your interesting presentation. It is always, to me, critical to reflect like that on the links between culture and tech. To me, it's an under-researched area. It's not a linear or mechanistic process. So I really thank you for your thoughts on that. Next up is our final speaker. The floor is yours.
Thanks, Michael, and good morning to the colleagues. I am just going to touch on three issues in the 5 or 10 minutes that have been given. The three issues I'm going to talk about, one is the notion of 4IR itself and the problems around it. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about why we are not talking about the actual youth policies that exist. And then the third thing I want to do is to reflect on research that I did 2018, 2019, and beginning of 2020 before the lockdowns, research I did on youth unemployment challenges in the Ekurhuleni region, specifically in Daveyton, Tembisa, and Etwadwa. So just to start off with, I think for me, in our discussion, we'll be remiss if we don't talk about the notion of 4IR, its origins, its contradictions, and its sources, you know. The person who's referred to as the father of the 4IR, Klaus Schwab, talks about 4IR in different ways. He talks about it as an era, you know, or as a moment, and then he talks about it as a future. And I begin to ask myself questions about the 4IR because, to start off with, and we can have this as a discussion point, ever since this notion gained currency in South African policy discourse, the first question I asked myself is it really true the assumption that all societies can develop in more or less the same way? And that in the case of 4IR, that, you know, artificial intelligence and the technologies around it are the inevitable path that we are going to take for development. I thought when we talk about development, it may not be that all societies can develop in the same way. Let me just put it like that. That's my argument. Because development itself is politically contested. And it's often located in ideological and historical questions, right? And I find sometimes that when we discuss the 4IR, we treat it as problem-free. We don't deal with the contradictions. We don't deal with the inequalities that a society like South Africa exposes. In fact, what we see is that the notions like 4IR actually reinforce some of the inequalities that exist in our society. As Wandile pointed out, the unemployment bloodbath and all these questions. So for me, just that notion and the fact that that notion is connected to another notion that people call techno-optimism, you know, the belief in that these technologies are the only path or they will be the main path for our development. And yet our society's history and the genesis shows us something different. Because of course, the main question is, so who gets to access this technology? From what class position are they coming from? From what social relations is this technology going to advance the changes that it promises to make? The second area that for me, I find quite strange that when we have these kind of discussions, I mean, when I was invited by Mahlatsi, I only heard that there's a policy dialogue on youth. So when I prepared myself, I thought about youth policy itself. Youth policy in South Africa is not a new thing. In the democratic era, the policy has evolved. I think I'm possibly part of what is called the youth endala, because I was around in the early 90s when youth development policy was being developed for the democratic South Africa. And last night I was reading a paper by Professor Linda Chisel, Candice Harrison, and Sharon Mutala about the shifts in youth policy between 1990 and 1995. So what has actually changed? Because over the years, there've been a whole range of attempts to address youth unemployment. This era we're in is not new. Firstly, under the context of an RDP, for instance, policy framework, there was talk of mass employment through public works of young people who would have constituted what is called out of school youth. So before we spoke about the so-called NEET concept, we were talking about out of school youth. That was because after the struggle in the 80s and the 70s, there were a lot of youth who were dislocated in our Black community. So that kind of discourse has shifted to a discourse of the mid-90s at the height of GEAR and the early 2000s talk of youth wage subsidy, which also became a prolonged, and then it became reinvented into what is called a youth incentive scheme, which also became criticized both by academics and activists. And then it has been reinvented into various other programs, okay, and interventions like the youth employment scheme. So I think part of our discussion should talk about the evolving character of the state, right? And what is actually the role of the state in youth development? You know, if you talk to youth activists, a lot of them critique. Just a few weeks ago, there was a march to the Treasury. That march was to symbolize the need for more funding, the need for active youth programs and all of this, right? And I think our discussion is missing those discussion points. So that is a question we should discuss. For instance, in the context of COVID, because our title here is very busy, it's got fourth industrial and then it's got COVID-19. But if you talk about the context of COVID, there are other discussions happening elsewhere, right? For instance, about the idea of a basic income grant, which is not, again, not featuring in our discussion, okay? And I think that we should be discussing, just like those activists, you know, if we talk about the role of the state, so do the current interventions that dominate in youth discourse, like the YES program, do they result in strengthening capacity of the state or weakening capacity of the state, right? And if so, okay, if so, what does that mean for the big challenge that we have of addressing youth unemployment? So for me, the tendency of reducing youth development to voluntarism does become a problem in a context of a developing country with high levels of inequality and high numbers of unemployment amongst young people. Okay, so we have to talk about this. I'd like to talk about, sorry, have I exhausted 5 minutes?
You've exhausted 8 minutes. I'm afraid I need to ask you to wind up.
Okay, so I'm just going to, I really wanted to talk about the research I did in Davidton, because in that research, let me bring out three themes that came out of my work. Okay, so these are qualitative research interviews with over 50 young people, okay? And grouping and organizations that are involved in youth development.
Apologies, Sapiro. We need to proceed with the program.
Okay.
For your concluding thoughts, and we'll move on.
No, fine. I think through discussions, people can raise questions about the research that I've done. I've published a paper in the New Agenda last year about some of this. And the reason, let me underline this. I think the discussion on youth unemployment is incomplete if we can't make sense of the concrete realities of the lived realities of young Black people in townships and rural communities. That for me was the purpose why I went to do the research qualitatively through interviews and so forth in Davidton, Tembisa, and that Ekurhuleni region, because I think that yes, the field of youth research is very strong on the side of the technical aspects, the statistics and so forth, that's fine. But I went to do the sociological research because I wanted to understand those lived realities. That's why I went into those townships. Okay, sure.
Sipilo. Right, we're slightly behind schedule, but we still have some time left for discussion. So I'd like to again thank all the panelists. Sipelo, it was really good to hear from you a critical lens of the 4IR, which really needs to be included in any meaningful discussion on the topic. We don't think it is all good. And also the interrogation of youth development policy, which I think should also be tabled at this discussion. So at this point, we open up for questions. I'd like to invite you to either raise your hands on the Zoom platform or pop a question in the comments, including the panelists to whom your question is directed, and we'll take it from there. We all still deep in thought.
Michael, I have my hand up, if you don't mind me going.
Please proceed, Palestine.
Yes, I'd just like to find out from the panelists, particularly from Lihle, and having had the tax implications of 4IR from Wandile. I'd like to find out, given that we are thinking of practical implementation solutions, you know, to incorporate this formal market in the fourth industrial revolution aspirations or ways of doing things. I mean, I think oftentimes, I do not think most of the informal sectors do participate in tech submissions, you know? And so I'm trying to figure out if we were to take it, do we think also the informal markets, I do understand that the informal markets in South Africa, they're big and probably even anywhere else in South Africa. And then, and they also, they sustain many families. So now in the light of tax implications that come with that, if we have to apply this 4IR in the informal market, what would be the direct implications or how do we mitigate the unwanted, you know, the unwarranted and unwanted outcomes that might emanate from implementing such, particularly understanding the tax context in South Africa and the tax dissatisfaction in South Africa. I think most of people at this point in time, they just feel that tax collection in South Africa amounts to a wastage. Oftentimes, there is poor governance when it comes to tax collection for use to make sure that it goes to proper state services or service delivery. So I'm just keen to understand really the combination of 4IR, tax environment, and the implications or the anticipated outcomes should we get that model right or those regulatory issues. Thanks.
Thanks, Palesa. Panelists, would you like to respond to those comments?
Yeah, Mike, I can just go first.
Please proceed.
Okay, so I think what really happens with, you know, bringing more tech or bringing more 4IR into the informal markets is that firstly, it will enable the markets to be able to address a broader target market. So where one would be operating in their either rural area or in their location, and they are only bound to those customers that are around them, technology can enable them to start marketing and selling their products on a more broader space and being able to target people who are not even within their geographic location. So I think that on its own already enables those people to start having or growing their revenue aspects. And yes, the challenges that come with, you know, having tax implications within that space, but I think if we are able to sell it and to show the benefits that will be brought about by having 4IR initiatives or innovation within the informal space so that we can enable those people to be able to sell their products to a more broader audience and hopefully grow that business. Yeah.
Michael, could I come in?
Yes, Krish, proceed.
Yeah, on this point about tax, I did some work with a platform that's based in Alex, and they support the Spaza shop market in the townships. And what they found is that they have great difficulty in signing up Spaza shop owners onto their platform. What they do is they go out and they do bulk purchases on behalf of the Spaza shop owners. But they're forced to operate on a cash basis because the Spaza shop owners are very hesitant to get a bank account because they're worried that there's going to be some record of all their transactions and then the government's going to come in and take their money through tax. So that's the fear that's there, and it's very prevalent. But as Palesa also said, it's quite unfounded because there is a threshold that these Spaza shop owners actually need to surpass before they actually do need to pay that tax. So there is this, there is a need for greater tax literacy out there so that people in the informal market actually know what is required. And then this becomes a barrier for us that we're not able to onboard new people into digital technology. So we're not getting new access to financial accounts, and so people aren't able to sign up to many platforms that need you to have a bank account. So these are some of the challenges we need to address. Thanks, Michael.
Thank you, Krish. Matsetse Bale also has a response to that. If you can show your video, that would be nice. There we go.
Okay, thank you, Mark. Responding to what Bale is saying, I think 4IR has also enabled government to support the informal sector to register their businesses easily. When I speak with a lot of young entrepreneurs that are still very much in the informal sector, you find that they think that to register a business is like 2,500 rand. And they get shocked when you tell them that with the CIPC is 175 rands and you can register your business with your cell phone. And automatically after you register your business, you get your tax registration with SARS. And that, I think, is also a beautiful platform that I previously saw, that it creates a platform to have a conversation with young people around tax and where they could get support and how. And you tell them, look, then businesses that are making less than this, they just need to... Was I muted?
Yes.
Just for a few seconds.
Okay. But yeah, I think I was just rounding off my point that with 4IR, government is able to also consolidate how it brings the informal sector into every conversation around the taxation process. Thank you.
Thanks, Matsetse Bale. We have another question from Teresa Moyo.
Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity, and thanks to all the presenters for the very informative presentations. My comments are as follows. I really think this is an extremely important issue that's under discussion, because yes, indeed, the fourth industrial revolution has some costs in the sense that it can displace labor, but it also has immense opportunities to create jobs for the youth. But how this can come about, I think, requires intensive planning, a holistic planning at national, provincial, and local government levels. You need policies. Obviously, the policies are there, but I don't know to what extent they go into how youth can be empowered in terms of the skills required for the fourth industrial revolution. So I think we need a national strategy. If it is not in place, I mean, I still have to read extensively on this, a national strategy on how to institutionalize the building, capacity building for the youth in terms of the 4IR related technology. And secondly, I also think that there needs to be information sharing, information dissemination. Where do we find the youth? Where are they located? Do they have access to information on the various training programs that may be available? Maybe not. So it is about disseminating that information, the public sector institutions, governments, NGOs, private sector, to have a coordinated strategy to disseminate information to the youth about what's available out there. And even if they get to know what's available by way of capacity building, it's not enough. Many of them, as I think the gentleman from Agape indicated, finance is an issue, the lack of access to finance. So we need at national level to have perhaps a dedicated whole budget into investing into youth-related development activities, including capacity building on 4IR. And having said that as well, to be able to reach out to the youth where they are in different places, provinces, localities, I think there's a whole issue about infrastructure that enables them to harness and take advantage of these technologies. You know, you're talking about internet access, broadband infrastructure. Is it there in all our rural spaces, in some urban areas? So it's about a national strategy to ensure adequate infrastructure on what is required to facilitate and realize and harness the benefits of 4IR. Infrastructure also in terms of a decentralized approach at local level. How can these youth be mobilized? How can they, you know, be reached in terms of communication and training? And lastly, Chairperson, I want to speak about the mode of delivery of capacity building. Most of it is formalized through, you know, the education system, high schools, universities, TVET colleges, well and good. But a lot of the young people, especially the unemployed, are outside that formalized system. And I really believe seriously that we need, as part of the national strategy, to think about non-formal infrastructure to facilitate a training, capacity building of young people on 4IR related technologies. This is very important in my view. And also bringing on board is, I think there's someone from the 4IR Commission who spoke, the role of the private sector is very important. But you know, private sector, we have to understand how they operate. Private sector works on incentives. How do you get companies in Johannesburg to invest here in Limpopo province where I am? Because Limpopo province does grows a lot of supplies the country in terms of fruits and vegetables, but there's very little processing here, most of which can also use digital technologies and employ the youth. But how do you get companies to come to Limpopo province? What sort of incentives do they want? There needs to be, you know, a real serious thinking about how we can promote domestic investment, expansion of, you know, companies reaching out to disadvantaged or, you know, less developed provinces. What is required for them to do that? And to me, this will also in the process generate jobs for the youth. And lastly, it's about investing. Sorry, I've been saying for lastly, Chairperson, I promise this is the last point. I think the issue of finance is a critical one. I think Treasury, national government needs to invest more resources into youth development and focusing also especially on how to build capacity of the youth in harnessing and using digital technologies. It's got to be a holistic, comprehensive approach at national, provincial, and local level. But finance is key to build these skills. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thanks so much, Teresa, for those thoughts. Any responses from our panelists to Teresa's comments?
Yes, Michael.
Thank you.
So, yes, so I want to agree with Teresa. So, South Africa is playing a catch-up game, of course, in terms of policy responses to 4IR currently. Everything we do is really just about catching up to the new businesses that are springing up, which are displacing labor, which have impact on the finances as well, mm-hmm. and the financial sector. So again, I agree with her that we need a coordinated effort to ensure that young people can capitalize on these trends, and especially because there are funding issues that are involved in this. So my presentation was, of course, research driven, and what comes out of research, and part of that, I think there's someone that in the research that said, if a young person had come up with the idea of Facebook in South Africa, they would not have had the supports that the founders of Facebook had overseas. And this is because of how government and policy currently on funding and support for businesses is very much focused on the financial viability and financial returns, of which some, and especially new tech businesses that are springing up, that young people are trying to start, like new startup businesses, do not necessarily have, or do not rely on how we understand financial viability of how when they fill in the documents of financial support and how those documents require them to fill them up. And this is because some of these businesses have impact on other value chains. So they might be, it might take long for them to be financially viable, but they create employment in other sectors of advertising and other such things. And of course, on the issue of Palisa's question, formalization allows informal and small businesses to kind of have a spot to approach banks and apply for support. Now, this of course is again affected by how banks give support to small businesses. So this then needs to also change as new dynamics are involved with 4IR and the new tech businesses that are starting up and smaller, and how to support smaller businesses. Sure.
Thanks. Skipelo, I see your hand is up.
All right, I just want to lower my hand. I was just going to comment briefly on the two things that Teresa raised. Teresa raised the point about the programs. So one of the things I found that, we need to discuss a bit more, is that there is a tendency in some of the programmatic interventions of the state that are aimed at alleviating unemployment or training, there is a tendency of circulating young people. What do I mean by that? I mean the tendency where people move from a learnership to an internship, from an internship back to a graduate program. The graduate program relates to, so there are many programs, but there is, I don't think we've studied enough the tendency of circulation. I'm calling it circulation. You know, people, or some people call it learnership hopping. And there is a lot of that. And my analysis of that is that, again, it's because of the nature and the depth of the crisis, and that there are no opportunities in some instances in terms of formal work, okay? But the other thing we seem to overlook is the agency of young people, because young people are beginning to organize themselves. Even if it's a car wash in a township and making small income. When I did research in Daveyton and Tembisa, you find young people in places like Itwatwa organizing around food security, you know, planting food in food gardens. You're talking about young people in arts and culture groups. And these guys you sometimes see at the traffic lights, who are doing busking, you know, dancing in the traffic lights. Some of them are actually organized youth groups doing fundraising or finding means. So I think that a country at our level of development, we often talk in ways that don't start with the agency. Well, what is it that people are doing? And maybe the way the state intervenes should be varied. You know, it cannot be the same thing. So it might not only be for IR, it might be to help the guy who's trying to set up a food garden. That's also youth development. And help the guy who's in the arts and culture, trying to raise money, taking township kids, charging them R5, whatever, for training. What you have though, formally, you have, like for an example in Tembisa, you go, you find the job center in Tembisa. Okay, it's funded by social development. So young people go there, they fill in their CVs, they type up. There are a lot of those kind of interventions. And you cannot dismiss the value of those interventions. Although I asked myself the question, it's interesting that they are under social development in Gauteng, not under economic development. And it may tell us about the way the state views the depth of the youth unemployment crisis, that it has put it under social development in terms of building these centers and communities. Those centers do exist, right? And I don't want to drag the meeting talking about what I found there, but I can talk about it on another day. By the way, there's also a robotic center in Tembisa.
Thanks, Sipelo. We have another question from Yaku. Would you like to proceed, Yaku? Yaku, are you with us?
Yes, I raised a question in the chat box. And that is that I'm just wondering, what is the panel thinking about whether our school system are really preparing our youth for 4IR? Because my impression of 4IR is basically that you need like advanced mathematical and science skills, and that is not really what our school system are producing at this stage. And then also the issue that was raised there, the whole issue of connectivity in the townships. We recently had a workshop here with the local universities, Univen and University of Limpopo, and during lockdown, the students even struggled to access the lectures, you know, virtually. So the reality is just a challenge. Thank you.
Thanks, Yaku. please note, audience, we are out of time for Q&A, so that will be our last question. I'll invite our panelists to respond. Matete Bali, I see your hand is up. Would you like to comment?
Thank you very much, Michael. A quick one. I hear Spelo speaking about some of the facilities that are there in Tembisa. I'm not sure if you mentioned Alexander, but development has this arrogance of going to places that are closest to the cities. If you go to other areas in Limpopo, in the Northwest, in the Mpumalanga, their townships and the rural areas, they don't have this facilities. So that is also one issue that we're facing. And secondly, we have one delay here was also leading in the Fees Must Fall. We all know very much that the Fees Must Fall movement was young people being fed up with the inequalities in the education sector. And they mobilized themselves utilizing online platforms. And it's as if we as young people of South Africa do not take the issue of youth unemployment seriously, because to be quite honest, is our issue. Like the 1976 youth in Soweto, that issue was their issue. It affected them, they had to stand. And I think if there's one thing that we as young people need to do is we need to stand. A few years ago, women in this country were sick and tired of the levels of gender-based violence. What did they do? They came together, brought the president and said, let's talk about this issue. Right now, when I'm speaking, there's a gender-based, the prevention of gender-based violence and femicide NSP collaborative that is sitting every month to ensure that the NSP on prevention of GBV is implemented. There is coordination around that work. Why is it that we, Wandile, can't do that thing? One colleague just mentioned that the issue of developing centers to enhance youth employment is sitting in DSD. That is pathetic, you know? But where are the young people? I think we have power to stand. And until young people stand and ride on their agency as a collective or as a unit in South Africa, this thing might not be solved, because it is a youth issue, and young people must take leadership in making sure that this thing comes to an end. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Matete Bale. Our time is up for discussion. I'll just make a few closing remarks. Unfortunately, our executive director, Heidi van Rooyen, could not be present with us today, but I'll just reflect on the discussion a bit. It has been a real pleasure to hear from our panelists and from our audience the questions and debates and on this important issue. And what has been really great has been to hear a wide variety of perspectives on this matter, unemployment, youth development and technology. And I'm hoping that these different lenses will help us think through these matters in a critical and a productive way. We've thought about economic aspects, we've thought about the technology itself, policy issues, we've reflected on social relations and capitalism, financial and tax aspects, business development, and we've heard from experts in each of these domains what the issues and the debates and the options for us could be. And for me, this is a really great discussion, and I hope it's built some bridges between us and between our ways of thinking about it, and stimulated some ways of thinking about this problem that perhaps are new and innovative. You know, and I think it's an important debate as the national conversation unfolds during Youth Month. And we also exist in an international context where the experience of the youth is always changing and always something new and always challenges us to think differently about the experience and the prospects of the youth and how to address that from a policy level. So once again, thank you to all the panelists for joining us and for offering your reflections on this. We really appreciate it. And with that, I will hand over to Palesa to close our session.
Thank you very much, Dr. Castro, for the facilitation. And I would also like to thank Professor Lightness and Bayi for welcoming the guests to this meeting or dialogue. We will be having a series of these dialogues as we go. And of course, they will be planned to target policy issues in the country. As Professor Lightness did indicate in his opening remarks that HSRC's mandate really is to ensure that it does bring the public along with regards to, okay, sorry, I didn't realize you want me to go into the video. So as the Professor Simbai indicated that HSRC would like to take the public along with regards to engaging in policy, participating in policy. And of course, we are guided by the National Development Plan in making sure that we can foster a society that is science engaged, that is policy engaged, and critically carving their space and participation in policy development. So we really are appreciative of your time, and we would like to see you engaging with us on more of these topics or dialogues as we seek to advance that mandate as HSRC. So on behalf of the Impact Center and the Strategic Partnerships Directorate, I'd like to thank you very much for attending this session, and we look forward to engaging with you again in the near future. Thank you. Oh, sorry, I'd like to actually just say the meeting is over and we see you in the nearest future. Thank you, Michael. We can dissolve this dialogue.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.